ITQ Podcast episode 427, Dover Rally with SDR Play. Well, hello and welcome, fellow amateur radio enthusiasts, to this, our 427th episode of the ICQ Amateur Radio Podcast, supported this episode by our monthly and subscription donors. In this episode, we join Martin, M1MRB, Chris, Mike Zero, Tango Charlie Hotel, Martin, Mike Zero, Sierra Golf Lima, Frank, K4, Foxtrot Mike Hotel, and Bill, Whiskey Charlie 3 Bravo, and Leslie, Golf Zero, Charlie India Bravo, to discuss latest amateur radio news. Myself, Colin M6BOA, rounds up the news in brief, and this episode's feature is the Dover Rally with SDR Play. Well, as always, we'd like to thank our annual monthly subscription donors that help us out, pay our way, and keep your show advert-free. They follow a very simple model. It's called the Value for Value model, where they get value from your show, your ICQ podcast show, and in exchange for us not running adverts and, as they being beholden to manufacturers, etc., you get our independent view and voices in exchange for your kind donations to help us pay our way. So if you get value from today's show, we'd ask you to go to itqpodcast.com/donate. Well, as I mentioned, anything you send our way, show you the value you got from your show, will be put back into the show to keep it advert-free for you. Now we join Martin, Chris, Martin, Frank, Bill and Leslie to discuss and generate thoughts about the latest amateur radio news, including World Amateur Radio Day and POTA update prefixes. As always, hope you enjoy.
This is Karen, KD2GUT, and you hear me on the ICQ podcast roundtable discussions that take you deeper into some of the issues facing hams around the world. But why just listen when you can become part of the discussion too? Join us on Saturday, April 13th, and add your voice to the discussion. Visit icqpodcast.com for details. If you know our podcast, you know it's bound to get lively.
Well, hi guys, and welcome to episode 427 of the ICQ podcast and tonight's news roundtable for that episode. Tonight, I'm joined by Mr. Chris Howard, M0TCH. Hi, Chris.
Good evening, Martin. Good evening, guys.
Yeah, good to have you. I have Mr. Martin Rothwell, M0SGL, not in his studio, but he's with us.
I'm not in the studio. I'm in the house. I'm on the dining room table. Well, the equipment is on the dining room table, so I might sound a bit different. There's probably more of an echo, but I'm here. Hello.
Hello. We also have over there in the States, Mr. Frank Hell, K4FMH. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Martin. Hey, everybody. And I'm not at the kitchen table, but I'm hungry already.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I was just thinking, Carol cooked me a nice curry today, and I could go with a bit more, actually. Back into the UK, we have Mr. Leslie Butterfield, G0CIB. Hi, Leslie.
Good evening, Martin. It's great to be on again.
Yeah, good to have you. And hoping that Mr. Bill Varnes, WC3B, will join us when he can. He's been hijacked into a work situation, so if Bill joins us later on, we'll let him in. Yeah, good to have a good team tonight. Right. In fairness, and I'm going to be brutally honest about this, I do not do April Fools on this podcast. And this is not me lying to you. We do not do April Fools. So if anything slipped through, it fooled me as well. There were some very, very brilliant April Fools on the internet in the last few days.
Can I just suggest, Martin, that there are a number of fools on this podcast right now? We can present four or five fools on a recording. That would help in April.
He stands corrected, Martin.
Oh, right. I'll stand corrected.
I did hear a rumour that the clocks were going decimal, but hey.
Yeah, there were some good ones, but there were some good ones out there. The only problem I found, and this was nicely, is that although they were very well produced and you could work out, anybody who knew the subject could work out, anybody new to our hobby would have necessarily have believed them lock, stock and barrel because they were very believable and very professionally done. But hey, it's that time of the year.
Someone did suggest that 2 meters and 70 cems have been withdrawn worldwide. I'm like, that was so obvious. Yeah, how many people Googled that?
So there you go. Anyway, let's start with only the first news story. And World Amateur Radio Day is the 18th of April. So 2 weeks away from when we record. It's a Thursday, which is a shame. But then Thursdays, you're not going to get hammered by contests. So I think it'll be an interesting one. Frank, do you want to go first on this one?
Sure. This is a signal holiday for our hobby, of course, and the theme for this year is a century of connections, celebrating 100 years of amateur radio innovation, community, and advocacy. It's a worldwide event. The IARU is engaged with this, covers all the regions, et cetera. So it is an important thing. I will note this, that I'm sure this is propagated through some of the traditional news media as opposed to the amateur radio news media. One of my suggestions over the recent years for the ARRL, being a member of RSGB, I could sort of weekly argue that since I don't live in the UK, is that we need to also advertise not just to ourselves on things like this, but to the public. So I'm delighted that World Amateur Radio Day is going to be celebrated, and we certainly take note of it, and getting out and operating is a good thing. But I hope that we'll take the opportunity one day to just go crazy and buy an ad in the New York Times in the U.S., for example, or the London Times, to let people who aren't amateur radio hobbyists know that there is such a thing. Over to you, Martin.
Yeah. I want to say a lot of this is about promotion, and it's very difficult at the moment to always hit the market you want. Chris, what's your thoughts? I assume you're going to be working on the Thursday this happens, but if you get a chance to work from home, you're going to try?
Possibly. So I think it's a great, in all these days and things we have, I think are a great opportunity for us to promote the hobby. So yeah, I think it's good. I think it's just a great way you can put on Facebook, and people that may be friends that are not in the hobby or others, you know, that today is this. It's just a good way to, I think, to promote what we do and get the word out, I think. So I think it's a good one. And I always forget, unfortunately, when it happens. It's always too late. I always find out the day after or something. So it's a good reminder having it on the podcast that it's coming up shortly.
Well, certainly is. And being a Thursday, I know Edmund works from home on Thursdays and Fridays. So, Edmund, you're going to have to do some work, you know. But never mind. Leslie, what's your thoughts?
I was looking at this. Yes, the thing that I'm looking at is it's not a contest, which is great because I'm not a lover of contests at all. But it's about getting the hobby out to the general public. You may be pottering about doing the radio in a park or whatever, or doing World Amateur Radio Day, and somebody comes along and asks you what it is. Take the time, speak to them, let them know what you're doing. It's not a contest, it's not for points or anything like that. It's about getting the hobby out there to the general public, and therefore I think it's a good thing.
Let's say we have a smart radio day at the library on Saturday. The following week, I will put this into the smart radio website.
You know,
just showing what we're actually doing, and there is an actual World Radio Day. I don't want to put it in this week because it'll interfere with what I'm trying to do this week, but it's a good story, and I think a lot of people will enjoy it. Martin, are you going to get a chance to do any of this?
I don't know whether I'm going to be able to chance to, because my radio station is currently dismantled because the antenna broke, and I've got the antenna back up and it still needs tuning. So stuff is not quite working properly there. But I do like the story. Amateurs are invited to take to the airwaves, an excuse to get on the air. This is not a contest. Great. So no 5-9 nexters. Please, you know, if you're on the air, talk to people. Don't just give them a 5-9 next and go away. And if you've got people, if you're doing this in public, again, as you know, the others have said, it's a great chance to showcase the hobby for what it can do, not just what you like it to do, but what it can do as a whole. Chris mentioned is something that he, this kind of thing is the stuff you always forget. There are clocks and things that lots of people have, like ham clock, I think is a clock you run on a Raspberry Pi on just an old monitor. I wonder if that, or if not, then maybe it should, or you know, similar things exist where you could have amateur radio related events like global ones that could just flash up in there. You could set it to do that. I don't know. But yeah, overall, it's, you know, I see this as a good thing. 100 years of amateur radio innovation. Wow.
Well, as I say, we all agree it's a good thing. But what I'm going to throw something else in the pot mix, it doesn't have to be HF. You know, in fairness.
Could be anything.
Yeah, it could be anything. If you can talk to somebody down the road on a handy talkie and a general public go by, they'll be interested in what you're doing. Secondly, that person on a handy talkie, and I've done it, been out and I've worked people on 2 meters or 70 sims on a Saturday afternoon. And they're over the moon that you've actually worked them. So there are people on the bands where the contests aren't. And there's nobody says you have to do it on HF. You know, it's promoting amateur radio. It didn't say it's promoting HF, although most people would probably want to do that. But in fairness, all bands are radio. So enjoy the hobby, I would suggest. Right. Let's move to our next news story. International Marconi Day 2024. Now, a few years ago, I went and did an International Marconi Day with the Essex Hams boys. I think Chris and our friend Neil went with us, and we had a great day out. But 25th of April. Chris, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's another day, isn't it? A bit like the International Amateur Radio Day, or World Amateur Radio Day, sorry. Similar idea, isn't it, I suppose? Another great way of promoting what goes on. It's great that we are, I suppose, celebrating Marconi, because he was always a very important person in the history of radio. And it looks like there's various things going on. It was created by the Cornish Amateur Radio Club, GX4CRC, because I do know that he did have, Marconi had quite a presence in Corn, didn't he? I think he had some a station or something there, was quite famous. Yeah, it's midnight until midnight, UTC. And need to register with that society to get involved. But yeah, it looks like it's going to be an interesting one, and certainly worth commemorating Mr. Marconi's legacy.
Yeah, well, Marconi is a big name in our hobby, and certainly, you know, worth celebrating. So I would suggest there. Martin, what's your thoughts?
I was going to say, Marconi, wasn't he your lab partner back when you were in your late 30s, wasn't he, Martin? Sorry, I'm only cheeking. I like this. It's an opportunity to contact historic Marconi sites using techniques that he would have used back then. No, I like this, but I suppose there's the if you've got all the technology you can get on the air with, maybe. But the technique is, in my head, that is going to be Morse, is it not? So that might limit certainly my involvement in any way in doing this, because I don't do Morse. But also thinking about the technology that he would have used back then, you know, they were using spark gap transmitters, which can't be tuned. So be careful if you've got a spark gap transmitter and you're thinking about putting that on the air.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I would suggest mine doesn't have to be Morse. I mean, bearing in mind, I think Chris will confirm it, but we saw part of Marconi's first shack, which turned into the first BBC radio station. I think it was 2LR, if I remember right. And that was in part of the shack is in the museum there up in Essex.
I think it was, is it Chelmsford? Yeah, I remember going to the museum there with the shack in it, yeah.
They've certainly got stuff Chelmsford, Danbury, why I know they have, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah. So he did a lot of work around there. But yeah, good one. Frank, what's your thoughts on Marconi Day? Are you going to celebrate in the States?
Yes, Marconi is certainly one of my heroes, as I'm sure everyone else on the team today would agree with that. I sort of feel like he set sort of a standard for this thing called radio and what to do with it in many ways. Today, the official day is on April 27th. He was born on April 25th, but I guess they've designated the 27th this year. I was delighted to see this on the ARL website. I'll wax historically for just a moment. Back in our podcast number 363, I had a feature called The Lost Tribe, The Pied Piper, and The Executive, in which I went through the early history of how amateur radio in the U.S. became an organized activity at a national level. And it's certainly not widely known outside listeners to that feature or the article published in the Spectrum Monitor about it. But Marconi had a larger national amateur radio group than did Maxim and his co-founder, Clarence Tuska, who actually taught Maxim about the wireless. That's typically not covered by maybe the ARL or many of contemporary hams. But if Marconi had not taken radio, as it were, then into the commercial world, and he had stayed in amateur, we might look at Guglielmo Marconi as the Hiram Percy Maxim of amateur radio. But money was to be made, and he launched the Marconi businesses for the Marconi telegraphy station. So I think it's a very important thing for amateur radio operators to engage in this celebration. So if you can get out and do this 24-hour event, whether you do Morris or not, it'd be a great thing, Martin.
Certainly will, Frank. Certainly will on that one. Now, Mr. Bill Barnes, WC3B, has just joined us, and we've said you would join us probably late, Bill. But what do you think about International Marconi Day?
This is one of those dates honoring Marconi that occurs every year, and it's a nice little. It's not really a contest; it's more of a memorial event. And I've taken part in this in the past, so it's good if you're, especially if you're a wallpaper chaser, you want to get a nice certificate. I know they used to do that. I'm not sure if they still do, but it's another excuse to get on the air, and we should encourage everyone possible to just get on the air.
Yeah, well, that's certainly what we're hoping, Bill. Certainly what we're hoping. Leslie, are you likely to do anything on this?
I don't know. Nearer the date, I'll ever decide what's on. But the problem is, I don't know what's occurring next week at the moment. A couple of things I've sort of read in the article. It talks about creating Marconi's Law. And I was sort of a puzzled look, and I thought, what's that all about? And then Frank mentioned about the square root rule, and I went, yes, of course. So that, and I believe Dr. Crippen wouldn't thank Marconi because he was the first guy to get arrested by the use of wireless. So that's a little bit of history on that. Frank's laughing in the background. He knows about that, so...
Well, I have a feeling you can go to a place in Cornwall and they tell you that story. There's something to do with Marconi there. I've heard that story. Fascinating.
But you don't need to use CW. Times have changed. Use whatever you want. But I wouldn't recommend Spark Transmitter. So you're not working a band so much. You're sort of working the whole of HF at once. So I'd park that idea for the moment. Over to you, Martin.
Yeah, I think you'd be in big trouble if you're using a spark gap transmitter today. In fact, they're banned, in fairness, for very obvious reasons. But yeah.
And just to finish off, Martin, in the Cornwall place, the place called Poldhu is the place, and there's a museum there. There's a place called the Marconi Centre that you can visit, which has lots of things.
I've been there. They've got like the pipelines that come under the telephone cables that come under the ocean that come up there. You can see the hut and things. It's fascinating stuff there, and they talk about that. That's a place that's really worth visiting if you're venturing down that far.
And there's a monument as well. Yeah, it looks an interesting place. And the place in Essex is called the Sanford Mill Museum, which I've just looked at, is actually sadly now closed, so you can't visit that at the minute. I don't know if it's going to reopen or not, but that's currently not open to the public, unfortunately, unless it's a special open day. So, that's if you're interested in Marconi, those are places it's worth going to visit, but obviously check to make sure they're open before you set off.
That's to say, that's the beauty of our hobby, is that not only do we get chance to play radio, but there's a certain amount of history, and other things relied on radio. I mean, radio was the technology 100 years ago that was really changed the world. And, you know, there's so much history around radio that makes it interesting. You come across these stories all the time, which is good news.
Well, I can imagine radio being thought was almost being magic. You know, you talk, or you perhaps not talk, but you can press a button here and that can be heard somewhere else and there's no wires. You know, I can just imagine that being absolutely the height of technology at the time and revolutionised the world. You know, news travelling around the world and stock market news and all that sort of thing is, made a massive difference to the way that the world worked. And to a big degree, I'd imagine made the world smaller.
Certainly did. So, great news story. And I think everybody is quite interested in doing it. I'm hoping to be out on Marconi Day operating as well. So, that's a good one. Right. POTA begins park prefix update. Now, POTA, Parks on the Air. And I'm going to pass this to Frank first because this is to improve their database, isn't it, Frank?
It is. And in our review of our stories in preparation for our episode today, I mentioned to the team that in my past life as a university professor, my laboratory lived, ate, and breathed all kinds of official data. And so standards for how to present certain data elements were something that we lived with. And POTA changing its park prefixes is causing a lot of gnashing of teeth by amateurs, but it's for a sound and good reason that will do the POTA organization and the practice of that particular part of our hobby in good stead, especially as it grows internationally. What they are doing essentially is they are changing the codes that they use to be part of the ISO 3166-2 standard. It's published by the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, and it defines codes for identifying principal subdivisions, provinces, states, and things like that. So when you have an administrative boundary or location, and POTA does that, these provide standards. Not everybody uses them, but it's a good thing for POTA, in my humble opinion, being a data person, to get in line with this standardization so that as the data for POTA gets used and gets propagated out, particularly to other countries, that it will be in a framework that will stand the test of time. I know it's a lot of academic gobbledygook, but it really does make a difference. So I'm all for it, and I certainly think that Jason Johnston, who owns the POTA effort, and his volunteers are going through a lot of legwork right now to help put this thing, in a standard framework, if you will.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I think it can only be a good thing to, come into standards with everybody else. It means that they're obviously intending longevity of parks on the air. And I'll tell you more about it a bit later, but I've started as well. Bill, I'm sure you've done some parks on the air. What's your thoughts on the database changes?
Yes, I have, and yes, it's a good thing. Latest information that was updated since the article came out. Originally, the article said that the China was not participating anymore. However, that as of March 25th, that's been resolved. So they were able to get China back into the POTA program. Either way, I mean, Frank really hit on this pretty well, but I just want to reinforce POTA is so popular that the overhead and maintenance and upkeep of that database on parks that are valid for activation and the ability to track things that an operator needs to know before they go to activate a park and stuff like that. They really needed to switch so they can get off the shelf data sets, and the ISO standard will give that to them so that now they can get a data set, merge it into their database with their numbering scheme and have less confusion. I'm sure this thing is a massive undertaking. You know, just even looking at how much activity is going on right now at this second, there's like 15 spots right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sorry, there's 27 spots that are less than 2 minutes old.
Bill, am I hallucinating? But has there been 1 billion contacts in Podi yet? I want to think I read that. A billion.
There was some press release I remember seeing at some point that there was a incredibly large to me number, but I don't recall the exact number at this time, and I don't have it here on the website. But it is incredibly popular. You know, the example I always use is, you know, one of the folks from the club went out to the state park nearby, which is a POTA compatible or a POTA location, put his spot in the system, had 40 people calling him within a few seconds. You know, he got done with the first CQ and it was like a pileup. It was just phenomenal how many people participate in this. And there's a whole award scheme around it. Every time I go out and check, like, you know, I got a whole bunch of awards out there for just working stations, because I haven't activated in a while now. It's been a couple years. I usually try to do the summits first. But the point of the whole article for this week is the folks that are taking care of this, and it is really a large team effort. They've made a decision on basically to scale this thing up, and by picking the ISO standards data, they're definitely helping themselves scale even larger. So I expect a lot more things to come out of this in the next couple of years, because this is just the first step that you would take in a large data project, as you know, Frank's historic depth of knowledge is he's done this probably 400 times in his career at this point. So this is definitely an opening situation that you need to clear up so that you can do bigger and better things later. So I'm very happy they were doing this.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bill. And in fairness, I think one of the reasons Parks on the Air has become so popular is there are so few rules. It's about getting out in the park, enjoying yourself, having a bit of fun. And, you know, even if you're a busy person and you can't get out to the park, if you hear anybody calling POTA, work them, because not only does that help them, but you also get logged as a hunter. So if you sign up for POTA, you might find you're logged umpteen times as a hunter because you work people. What do you think, Martin?
Well, I like the concept of POTA, you know, as anything, OTA, if you will. I personally don't collect details of those that I might have worked. If I want to know where something is, I'll be honest with you, I don't really care what they call it, what their naming convention, what their standard is. I'd rather just know your grid square. But if I don't know where it is, I just Google it, and then I'd find out where it is. So to me, this I don't really understand it enough. It does seem to me that someone has a bit too much time and is changing things, possibly for the sake of changing things. I would like to know who chooses what parks are eligible. I live between two massive parks, literally like 500 yards in either direction. Not even that.
I can answer that for you, Mark.
Okay. Well, I'll make a point. Like, one of them was frequented apparently by Henry VIII. And that is not valid. And so I don't understand. I mean, that is a classic place that really should, and it's huge. It's massive park.
Here's the answer. And I was one who didn't agree with their method, that when they expanded from the 2016 ARRL derived national parks on the air, the ARRL staff went, okay, done with that. moving on. And Jason Johnson and some others said, wait a minute, that was too good. We need to keep this alive. So they morphed it into Parks on the Air. And Jason actually, I think, trademarked the logo and sort of copyrighted and literally owned that entity, if you will. Now, what they do is like soda. You know, here in Mississippi, we're in sort of flatland. Well, the highest point in Mississippi is not a SOTA entity. The second highest place in Mississippi is. Why is
Bob? But they're both summits. They should both be valid.
But, well, from your point of view and my point of view, but if you think about a real mountain range, you'd have hundreds of summits that are all with close propinquity. And what Bob Witte, K0NR, here in Colorado, who's kind of a big-time soda operator, he lives near the mountains in Colorado, he said it's the relative prominence that makes the difference. Well, okay, being a GIS person, I get that, because if you get in the Rocky Mountains or the Appalachian Mountains, you would have all of these peaks that would meet the height standard, but they don't differentiate among themselves. There's no relative prominence. So instead of having 100 soda points, you just have one, because they're all little peaks and valleys in the same relative prominence. Now, that's the soda piece. For POTA, what they do is a similar operation, and they have some mapping people who go through and they actually research this, if you will. And if you look on the POTA.app site under volunteers, then you'll have a list of representatives who actually go through this. And one of the things that, in my humble opinion, they didn't really get was that when they added state parks to expand in POTA from national parks to include parks, they looked at each state and said, oh, each state has a parks and recreation agency. Oh, then they must have all the parks. Well, they have a lot of them, but not all of them. The large Old Trace Park just next to where I live is controlled by the Pearl River Valley Water Authority for whatever reason. That was not on the POTA site. And I worked for 2 years to get my mapping representative, Tom Suggs, N4MTE, who doesn't live in Mississippi but lives in Tennessee but handles Mississippi. He did graduate from Mississippi State University, so, you know, he is familiar to some degree. And so he did finally get it and did the work, because they actually have to go through the work of documenting these things. Now, that's a long-winded story to explain, Martin, your very, very, and may I say very again, common question, because I have a local club who did a big deal on a POTA activation, and they went to a park that was not on the POTA list. And I gently told their PR person, you may want to check POTA, because where you're going won't count for POTA. So it's a point of contention. And Bill may have some follow-up on this as well, but they are working hard. And I do think by the story we're covering today, they are working harder. And if people like yours truly think it's not working correctly, then I need to get off my behind and volunteer to be the Mississippi mapping representative. I haven't done that yet.
You learn something new every day, Frank, so thank you for that. But I would still say, you know, it's at the end of the day, if it's a park, you can still go out, you can still operate in it. There's nothing to say that you can't, as long as you do it safely. It might not classify for POTA, but it's still, you're still getting on the air with it, aren't you?
And you are absolutely correct.
If it's not with POTA, well, it's even more unique then, isn't it?
it is. So, yeah, I'll ring off it, but that's kind of the long-winded explanation for exactly a very common question, Martin.
What was the name of that park nearby that you said was on the list?
It recently is put on the list. Old Trace
Park. No, I meant park. For Martin.
Sorry, say that again. Sorry, what was the name of the park that isn't? They're not on the list.
Yeah, the one that you said that's near you that's not on the list.
Nonsuch Park.
Yeah, but I can argue Nonsuch Park has probably would be a worthwhile one. I would suggest Beddington Park would also be one, not a million miles from you or I, Martin, because Anne Boleyn's cousin, King Henry VIII, one of King Henry VIII's wives, used to go there.
Yeah, Nonsuch Park was Henry VIII. He had like a palace or something there. It was Nonsuch Palace or something.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parks. There's a lot of big parks in London. Interestingly, or in the south of London, I can remember. Interestingly, Richmond Park is actually on the Parks on the Air database.
Yeah, but you put an antenna up there and see how quickly you get stopped.
see, let me just add one more thing. There is a National Geographic Names set of organizations that is not totally unlike what we're talking about with POTA. And they struggle with naming rivers, streams, gulches, all these entities. And what their focus is, what is the cultural distinction of a place? And both Martins talk about Henry VIII, et cetera, et cetera. And so POTA is maturing and getting people who are into the guts of the procedures that embrace some of this, or maybe they could get some other volunteer consultants. It's growing, and some of these questions I hope, you know, might be answered and addressed, because it is what I would call an activity space that has blown up, and it's been dominated by the formal contesting community, but POTA is now a bigger enterprise.
Yeah, and the list of volunteers goes on and on and on. So there's definitely a lot of folks helping out with it. Now, I did look up Nonsuch Park, and the reason you have the exact same problem that Frank and I have. It's a county park. It's actually Sutton Council, Epsom, and Elwell Borough Council.
Yule.
So it's like the park that's right outside my development here. Yeah. That's run by a nonprofit for the county.
Yeah.
So,
but it's still a park. That's my argument. It's a big green space. It's, you know, it's got facilities for people to come and visit. It's a park, and it's a place that you have a prime place that an amateur radio station could set up. You'd be left alone. People probably wouldn't even know you were there.
But there's nothing wrong with you doing that, Martin.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's not, you're not recognized as POTA. But yeah,
and as there. Ramping up their infrastructure on database, and Bill, you certainly understand this extremely well. As they're getting more of these people, and then their development staff kicking in with this, I think they're going to get closer and closer to these things, because your points are impeccable.
Yeah. Chris, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of talk on POTA, but I think, you know, taking it back to the kind of POTA and other similar award schemes, I think they're actually extremely good idea. I think with amateur radio, you know, I think a lot of folks start out quite enthusiastic about getting on the air and working all the bands they can. And I think after a while, I think we sometimes perhaps lose our way a little bit in terms of, you know, what we want to, you know, what do we want to get out of the hobby. And I think these award schemes sometimes give us a little bit of purpose. You know, let's go and work all the squares in Britain or America, or, you know, or let's go and work all the parks. Let's go, you know, let's go and work for all the summits. So I think if you sort of, I think it gives us a little bit of motivation, a little bit of ambition to actually go away and get out and operate a radio. So I think these are a very good idea, and they kind of give us a purpose, don't they? I think a little bit, just to get out and an excuse to actually get out and operate a radio. So I think they're a great idea. As for this story about the change in the prefixes, well, yeah, okay, if that's what they need to do to comply with certain international regulations, then I guess that's okay, isn't it? I don't suppose it's causing anybody any major concerns. If it's something they can sort out fairly easily, then I guess that's what they should do.
Well, once the database is sorted and the prefixes have changed, everybody's going to use the new prefixes. So I don't see it as a major thing. What I will say is both POTA and SOTA, in my opinion, suddenly give you somewhere interesting to go that you might not ever have thought of going there. Yeah, and I can operate in some lovely parks close to me, and I do, and I thoroughly enjoy it. But I was out last Saturday. I ended up on a POTA site. And I got to tell you, I never knew this place existed. And driving up to the summit, of this Potter car park. You know, I'm looking at this unmade road and I'm thinking, nobody's ever going to go up there. And I got to the top and there were 30 cars up there, you know, and it looked like an unmade road half the way up. So more of that and what I've been doing. But it's a good thing. I think it's changing the prefixes. So good one for Potter. What do you think, Leslie?
Martin, well, I've been listening with interest because I knew absolutely nothing about this before. It certainly seems to be generating a lot of activity, good activity, and also getting people out, getting radio amateurs out and operating, which is also a good thing. Get some fresh air. I'll do a little bit of operating, some sandwiches and a nice flask of tea or coffee or whatever. Yeah, why not? Let's go for it. Why not?
Yeah, well, I got stitched up because there was a picture on the Ask You Facebook page that of me with a big smile on my face with Edmund's little Yagi on a tripod and a handy talkie. And I think the smile says it all. But there you go. Right, let's move on. This is, I think, the FCC coming into line with everybody else. Bill, you're a security type person, so I'm going to get you to go first on this, but two-factor authentication for registration system is being put in place at the FCC.
Yeah, I saw that, and that's a good change. It's clunky. They're just having it send you an email, so that takes a little time. However, this will protect folks from getting their accounts hijacked if their password gets compromised. So I think any kind of security improvement like this is a good thing, because you definitely don't want folks jumping in there and messing around with your account. Definitely don't want that to happen. So I think this is a good one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you on that one. So, Martin, what's your thoughts?
FCC to implement 2FA. Well, welcome to the 21st century, I guess. I mean, I heard of 2FA around 2001 and we were using it at work. I know websites and things, you know, were quite well behind at that point. But yeah, it's 2FA's only got to be a good thing. Just what took them so long?
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think it's coming and there's not a lot of big changes we can do there. Chris, you agree on this one?
Absolutely. I think we should have 2FA on everything we possibly can have on, really, even things that may seem innocuous in innocence. If someone hijacks your account, that can cause all kinds of problems. So, no, I agree with what Bill said earlier, that, you know, it's something that we should have really everywhere, ideally via some kind of app on your phone or some sort of device. I mean, email, I guess email works, but, and I'm aware that there are some concerns around using things like text messaging for 2FA, because people can actually hijack your, if you're not careful, if it's something important, they can actually hijack your, if they think it's worth it, they can actually hijack your messages. So, but no, definitely makes a massive improvement to security just over a simple username and password. So I would have to say it's a good idea.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the bad people keep trying to work ways of upsetting and ruining our lives. So this has got to come in.
Well, I mean, yeah, nothing's perfect, but this can make it much, much more difficult for an attacker to hijack and get into your personal private stuff.
Yeah, well, if you've got two-factor authentication and somebody else hasn't, they'll do the other person first because that's a lot easier. I think these people are lazy, the people they do what they do. Leslie, what's your thoughts?
Well, looking at this, I think it's just an inevitable. We're going into more and more of a digital age, and people don't rob banks anymore. They do it via a keyboard. You know, that's a tad old-fashioned way of doing things. So I think two-stage authentication, it's just one of those things that is with us now, and I think it's going to increase. There are people out there that try and do silly things, and hopefully this will put them off.
I hope so. Frank, last words on this one?
Well, the ARL went to it a couple of years ago, I think. So it is sort of something we need to do. And with the news here in the States of AT&T finally discovering that they had a major, major data breach. It included my account. I've changed my password. So it's just sort of proof positive that this is something that needs to happen. Be prepared for the wailing and gnashing of teeth by some sector of U.S. hams who have a hard time getting into the FCC licensing system cores. Now, they'll claim this is just making it harder and harder, but it's just about keeping up with the traffic on the interstate highway. The Autobahn may be a very speedy one, but if you get on it, you have to keep up the pace. So it's a necessary thing for us to do. And most of these six-digit secondary codes, it's more of a copy and paste nuisance for the end user, but it's a good one.
Yeah. Well, it's good that they're moving with the times and protecting our data, which is the important thing. So good one there, guys. Right. I wasn't sure about this next one. I did check with Frank and he said, yeah, he agreed that they did say it wasn't April Fool's one, but the BBC Radio 4 is dropping AM medium wave in April. Now, we do know a lot of AM stations have gone off the air. Martin, this is probably the area you know the most about. What do you think?
Been on the cards for a while. I was equally as surprised as you were when I learned that Radio 4 was on medium wave. They've been on long wave for years on 198. There's a whole argument of that they don't want to pay to upgrade the transmitter. They want to turn it off. And that's, you know, that we've covered that many, many times in the past. I kind of never really understood why this existed, or at least why it still exists, because Radio 4 have got national FM coverage and it's really good FM coverage, somewhere about 92 to 94 FM, something like that. But yeah, 720 kilohertz in London. I think they've got about 10 to 12 medium wave transmitters across the country. It was on the Radio Today website pre April the 1st, so it looks like it's definitely happening. It's unsurprising, you know, lots of other stations are going off on AM as well. There's lots of background noise. Cars don't always have AM radios in them. More people are listening on smart speakers and on their phones. The transmitters have to run tens of kilowatts to obtain the same level of coverage that the FM can. You know, FM for London probably runs 4 kilowatts. An AM for London, I think, the gold they recently switched off was something like 97 kilowatts, which, you know, is considerable costings. When you add that up across the transmitters across the country, it's unsurprising that they want to turn it off. I will ask the question, and I know the answer to this, but I'm going to say it anyway, is will the BBC, which, by the way, we are forced to pay for, whether we are interested in their programming or not, will they offer any of those cost savings as a reduction to the BBC tax? I somehow doubt it.
I very much doubt it, but then maybe we won't get taxed quite as high for other services.
Oh, I very much doubt it, yeah.
I live in the past, mate. Of course it ain't going to happen.
Oh, yeah. An ordinary black and white license.
Yeah, I had one of those once. Right, sorry, what Martin's referring to is...
But TV works just as well without it.
Yeah, TV licenses. Years ago in the UK, you had a black and white or monochrome license or a colour license. You don't think you could buy a black and white license anymore because I don't think anybody makes them.
I'm just bitter that I got the bill for it and it was like 150, 160 odd quid. And I don't even watch the blimmin' BBC. Why have I got to pay for it? Just because I happen to own a television. Anyway, that's a whole other... Get me off my soapbox.
Yeah, understood. No problems. Chris, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think this has been on the cards for a long time. I know the Director General spoke about it a little while ago, talking about, you know, ultimately he was suggesting that all of the BBC services were likely to become eventually, and he wasn't giving a time frame, online. You know, they won't be a kind of radio, essentially, over the airwaves version of BBC radio. Certainly it would be kind of online via the internet, which of course is also going over RF if you've got a mobile phone or the like. And I do recall, I think we talked about this before, certainly on long wave, not so much medium wave. I think there is a transmitter, I think it's at Droitwich, where they have some very large valves or tubes, as our American cousins call them. And there's only so many left, and there's only they're no longer maids. And once the final one kind of decides to stop working, that will be the end of Longwave. And I think actually that they are pulling Longwave as well fairly soon. So
2025, I think Longwave goes. They're waiting for the power companies to switch over teleswitching.
Okay,
which relies on it.
So it is unfortunate. I think it's inevitable. And I think you were saying, Martin, earlier that there are, you know, let's face it, most people that are using radio are probably in their car at the time, because that's, we are kind of a bit of a captive audience. Although lots of people enjoy it in other places as well. And if cars don't have AM receivers, you know, medium wave or long wave receivers in them, then what's the point? You know, a large part of their audience aren't benefiting. So I think they can move with the times. I understand there's obviously a lot of cost involved in maintaining and running these sites, these transmitters. So it's a bit of a shame, but I get why they're doing it.
I've got to be honest with you, Chris. I mean, you hit it on the head there. People listen in their cars. Think about it. And considering I work in radio as well, I don't own a radio in my house. If I were listening to the radio in my house, I say my Echo's name. I won't say it now because it wake everyone up. Play this radio station and it streams it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, and equally in the car, because the coverage is so patchy, I just listen to it on my phone. Why pay for these transmitters if people can't use them, aren't listening to them?
But in a way, what's actually happening is the BBC are actually transferring the cost of their broadcast to you by paying for your
exactly
for your, you know, your data,
your phone,
service,
your internet. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Interesting concept, boys. Interesting concept. Leslie, what's your thoughts?
I was just mulling as a discussion went on, and two things sort of came to mind was changing technology, which people have alluded to, and also finance. You know, just running a small team of people in an office, it's a considerable amount of money, and it gets worse and worse every year. And at some point, somebody says, no, we can do this a lot cheaper, we can do it a lot better. So I think that's what's happening, and it's just one of those things. And I have radios knocking about in the house, but most of the time I listen to stuff that's being streamed over the internet. So I'm as guilty as anybody else on that. So I think times are changing, as they say.
They certainly are. They certainly are. But I know, Frank, and I'm going to pass to you next, Frank, I know that, you know, there are people that are still listening on medium wave and long wave, more medium wave in the States because you don't have long wave, but they're DXing these stations, and as more and more of these AM stations go off the air, the DX coming in must be more fun.
Well, I sort of cut my teeth at age 8 on I didn't know I was DXing. I was just listening. But I sort of got my love of radio transmission and how it behaves, you know, through medium wave. And I think many, many hams in their testimony about their relationship to the hobby would say, I got started broadcast band DXing. So there is a historical legacy to our covering this, albeit in this case in England or in the BBC. Now, one comment I would bring, and I share Leslie's opinion, I have streamed stuff through satellite in my truck when I'm traveling around doing that. I listen to other streaming things too. Who listen to AM at night, almost every night with earbud, and I just sort of stream around. I have marker stations that I tune to, and I'll listen to some things before I go to sleep. But I think there's a real difference between the developed world and the developing world. In developing countries, medium wave can be very important. In South America, shortwave, as Don Moore's recent book on the DX Traveler or some, that's close, it may not be accurate there. And it's often the medium that can get out and that people can listen to. Now I'm merging medium wave and shortwave there, so forgive me for that. In developing countries and undeveloped countries, there's a tendency, but not a certainty, to have repressive political regimes. And they have a hard time figuring out where your dial is set on the radio. They can figure out what you've been listening to via the internet, and they can turn that internet off. So I think there's a dynamic of the political economy of nations around the world with regard to medium and to some degree shortwave that I would simply point out to our listeners. We are changing in the developing world.
We certainly are, Frank. We certainly are. This is a good one. Bill, have we left you anything to say on this one?
No, not much. I've never listened to the medium wave, at least that far. I mean, our AM band is a little bit, I'm trying to think if it overlaps or not. I'm not sure. But I have listened to BBC on shortwave, but I've never listened to it on long wave or medium wave. So, sorry. I know that they have to make the business decisions. And the one thing I will say is Frank and I know in the States, every state has different tax structures at the state and local level. And it's crazy the kinds of things you pay taxes on. But thankfully, we didn't get with a TV tax. Not yet. We do have a lot of taxes on our cell phones. That's the one that's really comical is they put a charge on there. They call it a fee for E911 that has been implemented for, what do you say, Frank, 20 years now?
Yeah, at least.
Tax never went away. And oh, by the way, my friends that work at the local 911 center say that they don't even get that money. They don't know where it goes. So it's all good.
Well, there's only two certainties in life, boys: taxes and death, and both of those are not very nice. But in fairness,
still not sure about death, by the way.
Oh yeah, well, we might be wrong that as
long as we're sure about the taxes.
Yeah, we're sure about that one. But I must admit, I grew up with medium wave, falling asleep of a night time with my ear resting on a little pocket transistor radio when I was about 11 or 12 most nights, albeit listening to pirate radio stations in the North Sea because they were the only ones playing popular music back in the 60s. The BBC didn't, but yeah, it's kind of, I grew up with it, so I kind of still like it, but I don't have that many AM radios in the house anymore, like you say. Yeah, as they've died and I've not bothered to fix them, they've gone. Never mind. But end of an era, potentially. End of an era there. Right, let's move to our last news story. And nicely, Chris, you put this one in, but I think I should have done. Chris Widmarsh, G0FDZ, who we have met a few times, receives an RSGB Lifetime Award for achievement. Now, Chris, I know, has done a talk for us at the club. I think he's worked contacts on every amateur band. And last time I spoke to him, he was talking about phenomenally high microwave frequencies that almost sort of blow your mind when he's talking about it. But Chris, do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, so yeah, we certainly met Chris. He did a talk for us a few years ago for our club, and I think it was something like millimetric frequencies, so incredibly high frequencies. Chris is an avid builder, constructor of kits. I know he was building transverters and things to work on many, many frequencies. I know it looks like this award has been given by the RSGB, which is a lifetime achievement award. It was given by the RSGB president, and also present was the RSGB board chair as well, Stuart Bryant. Yes, basically the award has been given for being the only amateur in the UK to have had two-way QSOs on every single amateur band for which he's licensed. So that's quite an achievement. I mean, certainly when I look at my license, there's lots of bands there that I've never probably never going to work. And he's made it his job to go ahead and meet that challenge. He's also very active. I know there's a couple of beacons as well that Chris looks after in the VHF and UHF ranges here in the south of England. So he's certainly a busy chap, and I think it's a well-deserved award.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. Well-deserved, well-deserved. Leslie, what's your thoughts?
You've already used both words, well-deserved. I mean, we tend to sort of be a particular person, you know, and I like playing with HF a little bit of UHF, but I've never, ever used some of the frequencies that he's talking about. So very, very well deserved and well done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you wouldn't get many contacts up there, but it's got to be a great achievement.
But you can't get the stuff off the shelf. It's something you've really got to have the skill and the knowledge of putting the equipment together. And to be honest, I'm nowhere near it.
Yeah, well, I remember him talking to me at the club, and he said some of these things, these diodes up at the microwave level, he said they're so small if you sneeze, you've lost it. While you're trying to solder it in. But very interesting guy. Martin, still a UK story. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, well-deserved. I mean, I certainly don't want to put this down. Is he the only person that's done this, or is he the only person that's stepped up and said, hey, I've done this? I don't know. But yeah, I guess the fact that you've got to build the stuff to do, you can't buy off-the-shelf components or off-the-shelf black boxes, if you will, to operate these things, that has got to account for the achievement of being able to do it. So, yeah, well done to him.
Yeah, well, if I remember right, and I could be totally wrong, I'm going from memory, Chris worked for British Telecom in their research and development. So he's quite a clever guy and, I'll say, lovely guy to chat to. I've met him a few times. So.
I remember the GB3 VHF talk. That was fascinating. He was fascinating then.
Yeah, yeah. Long time since I've chatted to him, but he's a great guy to talk to. Right, Bill, I know this is a UK story, but working every band, that's got to be something different to most people, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm looking at my US frequency chart, which is actually might be, yeah, I don't have the two very low frequency bands, but, you know, like in the States, we get all frequencies above 275 gigahertz. So I wonder if you had a QSO up there, that would be just phenomenal just to do even just that, let alone all the other bands. So I you know, all any kind of story like this, I really like reading these because it really is important that we stop every once in a while and thank the folks that are doing some really neat and interesting stuff in the hobby. There's folks out there they're donating a lot of their time to keep the clubs going. They're helping with public service events.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff there, and I'm just thankful and grateful that the RSGB gave Chris this Lifetime Achievement Award. It's very well deserved and very... I just love reading these stories.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure that he has worked at a couple of hundred gigs or whatever the band is up there. I'm sure he told us he did that when he did the chat with us, but could be wrong. It was up going from memory here, but really interesting guy anyway. Frank, last words on this one?
Sure. Keep in mind, to have a two-way QSO, you got to have another ham on that band. So... That's something to think about. I echo everything everyone has said, and I'll simply say this. Good on the RSGB, because societies like this, and all the way down to the club level, one of the important functions that they perform is to honor service and accomplishment. And so we've all said what an incredible accomplishment this is. You'll find, I'll say niche, not to diminish what they do, but they are relatively unique in that sense of niche. Hams that do things that when we find out about them, kind of us middle-of-the-road average hams, we go, that's incredible. I've noticed that there are some areas of focus in our hobby that don't require as much of the homebrew arts as others do. The really high frequencies, the super high and above, have tended to require that homebrew set of skills, because you just couldn't go to one of your popular ham stores and buy everything you needed. You know, ICOM with their IC905 has begun to make a commercial foray into some of those bands, but certainly not all. So I certainly am enamored with Chris Whitmarsh, not for just what he did by making the QSOs, but he had to homebrew much of the equipment to do that with.
Yeah, good works, Frank. Good words on that one. And as I say, a well-deserved award for Chris. Hats off to you, sir. You're a lovely gentleman. Right, let's find out what the guys have been up to since the last time we had a chat. Bill, I'm going to go to you first, just in case work calls you back again. So do you want to go first, Bill?
Yeah, I actually have to split soon to grab the children here. But not much has been going on the radio. I worked a couple soda stations in March here and worked Albania on 10 meters at the end of the month. Had a really interesting solar flare during the contest weekend. Big sideband contest. I think it was last weekend. Did a little work in that. But the interesting thing to me was the solar flare that wiped out the bands. But there was still a lot of activity. So it was kind of interesting because there was, you know, not as much DX as I expected, but the folks stateside were still calling CQ, trying to keep their rates up. So that was interesting. And likewise, those that are on the Facebook group know that I drive past Ham Radio Outlet in Delaware every year when I'm on my way to Ocean City, Maryland. And I finally stopped. And so I never stopped. And so it was exactly what you expected is it's a store that has pretty much everything from their online catalog there. And you can just, you know, buy it there and walk out with it. And just like, you know, Radio Shack used to be. No, I didn't buy anything before anyone wonders. I was the beginning of our weekend vacation. I didn't want to spend the money until after vacation, but we didn't come back with much, so I didn't stop on the way home. But that was neat. I always wanted to stop there, so that was a fun, you know, 15-minute break from driving.
Oh, sounds like your break was well worth a bit of fun, Bill. And yeah, maybe I'm not sure if we pass any ham radio dealers while we're out in the States after we leave Dayton, but I'm sure if we see one, we'll probably have a stop and have a nose round. So that sounds fun. Right, Frank, what have you been up to radio-wise since we last spoke?
Two or three things here. I'll be kind of brief. My third article in a three-part series on transmit quality and HF transceivers is in the current Practical Wireless magazine. So that series is now out in the wild. I've been scheduled to give a talk in a few months to the Denby Dale Club on transmit quality. So I'm happy to do that. I put together a little kit from QRP Labs, a 20 watt dummy load. And Hans did what I think is an ingenious design on a sandwich PCB boards to keep the stray inductance down. When I swept it, it was pretty darn good through the HF range. So I had ordered that when I ordered a QRP QMX transceiver just to save on shipping. So I put that little dummy load together. Did get the QMX. I did buy one that was assembled and tested. I just didn't have time to put it together. That little radio is just very, very well built. Came in the case, et cetera. Now, it likes no more than 12 volts. So I bought a small buck converter, a real small PCB board that I set it to 12 volts max. And built a cable, power cable, so it'll go from power pole in my 13.7 batteries that I have down to 12 and put some heat shrink over the small buck converter. So I built a unique cable for it. Looking forward to getting on there. Not with CW at this point. May learn CW down the road. I did become a lifetime member of the Long Island CW Club, but that's probably in name only for the time being. I will do some FT8 with it, and Han says he's putting out a firmware update for the QMX that will allow you to do sideband. So that radio is going to get popular in a hurry. Also on the bench, upgraded my SDR Kits VWNA VNA device to an automatic two-port version, but I somehow lost the firmware on the ATMEL board, Atmel board, Tom Bayer was kind enough to email me instructions on how to reprogram it. I had to order a programmer device for the Atmel board, which I probably need to have one anyway. I really like that VNA. It's got tremendous sophistication that Tom has built into the design and the updates. And it goes right along with my Libre VNA that goes on up to the gigahertz range and one of the nano VNAs on my bench. I love antenna building like so many of our listeners. And I've been tinkering with a camera light tripod. It's about 8 feet when you stretch it out. It shrinks down to about 18 inches. I was inspired by Jim Heath, W6LG's YouTube video about taking one of these and making a portable vertical antenna out of it. And I'm about halfway done. It's a challenge to get a telescoping mast to maintain continuity. And I've done some Dremel tooling and cleaning it out so it's metal on metal. And I may put some solder ridges in there so that when you pull it out, it will make sure it achieves continuity. Anyway, just kind of fun to fool with. And finally, one of the things I've noticed as Scott McIntosh and I are kind of eagerly awaiting this smooth sunspot cycle here to see how his projections go. Very often, you know, I'll hear Ham say, well, the smooth sunspot number is high, but the bands are terrible. Well, the smooth number never influenced our propagation. It's only the daily number that affects it. That smooth number is for us to simply be able to track the trends in a volatile data set. So I downloaded all the sunspot numbers back to the first sunspot cycle and began examining how variable the daily numbers are within a given month. And for example, last month, we had a high up almost 190 and a low down in the 30s. So it can be 150 points in a given month in sunspot number from low to high. Quite a bit of volatility. But that's only during the sunspot cycle's higher periods. When they're low, they don't change that much. So I'll complete my analysis of that and those data and see if it's worth a tutorial paper on it to be published somewhere. Feedback from our listeners, if that would be useful to you, pop me an email. I'm good on QRZ. That's about it, Martin.
Well, Frank, sounds like you put me to shame and you've done a hell of a lot of things. So that's good news and sounds like you're having real fun. Leslie, what have you been up to, radio-wise?
Oh, not very much, to be honest, due to various reasons. But anyway, what we are planning to do was we're planning to do the Chingford Village Festival, have a stand up there. So we're slowly putting the bits and pieces for that together, without trying to spend too much money. It's sort of I'm the treasurer of the local club, so I've been sorting out all the club issues and bits and pieces like that. But we have had a spurt of members giving talks, which have gone down very, very well. And I've been roped into one, roped is the operative word, to do one on cable losses. So I'm going to show how you can do it easily using one of these spreadsheets and then do it mathematically. But yeah, that's for interest if people are really wanting to it. And then show them how to do it the easy way. But use a good piece of coax, some of that Italian coax, and then choose some really rotten stuff that I've hit with a steak hammer and sort of Coca-Cola over it to really mash it up. And so that's in progress as well. So as soon as that's done, I'll give you the news on that, Martin.
That sounds interesting, Leslie. Sounds very interesting. So sounds like you're having fun. Martin, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Oh, it's been a while, isn't it? Because I was working. Yeah, so weirdly, not as much, actually. Been working on moving some of my radio equipment to my home office, but that means the longer cable runs. I'm trying to do it with a little loss as possible. I found out that 213 is actually better than RG8, and I'm just trying to see what else I've got that might be even better than that. I've rebuilt my HF antenna. I mentioned before that the storm that caused it to snap. I've rebuilt it to the exact same lengths, and the SWR is not. It won't tune in on a couple of bands anymore, so I don't quite know why that is. might be something to do with an Earth or something that I need to investigate. But otherwise, amateur radio-wise, not as much. But what might be of interest to people is, I do a lot of stuff with events, and we use radio mics all the time. Like, every single day, we use multiple radio mics. And we were trying to set up some radio mics in our studio, and we were just getting this noise, with the sort of a bleep underneath it constantly on the radio mics. And it just sounds weird. And I brought in a little RTL SDR dongle. We switched all of our equipment off, and I could hear it. So we knew it wasn't our equipment getting it. I walked around the building. I could hear it. I walked outside the building. I could hear it stronger. I have no idea what it is, where it's coming from, but it's literally right across all of our private frequencies, as well as the public frequencies for radio mics in a 600 meg range. It is there. And we toyed with the idea, okay, we could get Ofcom out to come and investigate it, because we pay for these frequencies. It was getting really annoying. I thought, okay, well, let's just get some of the other radio mics that run at like 800 odd megahertz, and we'll use. And again, they're licensed. And I listened to the band there. It was completely silent. They're brilliant. Switched the transmitter on of one of the radio mics, and this noise is back. Like, where the hell is it coming from? And it took us a lot of investigation. But these are for lavalier mics, the little silly microphones you clip on your tie and you put the transmitter in your pocket. And it transpired that the microphones that have the longer cable by about 6 inches seem to pick up this interference, send it into the transmitter, and then rebroadcast it over our licensed channel. Whereas the microphones with a slightly shorter cable are perfectly quiet. So that was an interesting bit of trial and error trying to work out what that was. I thought, okay, if we're getting that, it's clearly picking it up off of there. I'm thinking we're going to have to try and wrap some ferrite cores or something around the cable. But I thought, I can't do this to every microphone, stick it on people's backs, because by the time you do that, they're going to end up having the transmitter on their chest anyway. But yeah, that was what we found with that. And other than that, I've had a little bit of a play with D-Star the other day. It's always a good bit of fun. And I do pop up on the talk groups when I'm going to and from work, but sometimes there's people there, sometimes there's not. I did bump into someone, ironically, I apologize. I know he's a listener. I forgot his name. He lived literally around the corner from where I live. So I was telling him, oh, I live in this place in Southwest London. And I said, I know where that is, because he used to live on the other side of the park. And he now lives in New Zealand. I apologize. I've forgotten your name. It might be Peter, but I might be wrong, so I apologize for that, but hello to you anyway. So yeah, otherwise, just trying to recover from this weird bug that I've got at the moment, so not as playing as much radio.
Yeah, sounds like you've been doing a bit, Martin, and noise on your broadcast things could be a problem. We've had a gentleman turn up at the smart radio at the library for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and he came up the club a couple of weeks ago, and he does a very similar job to you. He's an audio engineer for big outside events, and there's a massive one happening in a park not that far from you in September. And he was showing me some of the software they use, and it was phenomenal. But
yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff.
Yeah, and he was talking about coming getting into amateur radio, so he understands the RF side better, which is good news.
Yeah. You have to learn it. There's things like Sennheiser cockpit and things that help you plan all your microphone frequencies and things, but yeah, it doesn't help you when you've got interference, because you still got to find it.
Yeah. That's what he wants to understand a bit more about, and that's why he's coming to us, which is good news. Right, Chris, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Not a huge amount. Interestingly, sort of, Bill mentioned going to a ham radio outlet. I remember going to ham radio outlet in Woodbridge in Virginia a few years ago and buying an MFJ ATU, which is still used today, which works very well, much cheaper than buying it here in the UK. And I thought, being an ATU, it's not there's not much by the way of electronics involved. It's fairly basic componentry inside, and it survived the journey and works very well. Yes, also been to those stores, or one of those stores, Bill, and no doubt we're in the States, Martin. We mentioned going to some ham radio. We're going to be at Dayton. I imagine there'll be a few there as well, to be fair. Radio club wise, we had a nice talk from Oscar about All Star. All Star is a digital mode that lets you link together various devices over the internet. and it actually also works with analog radios as well. So I believe it's based on the Asterisk platform that's used for VoIP. That was quite interesting. And of course, you and I, Martin and Edmund, went to the rally at the Dover Club a week or so ago. So I think we're going to be running the interview I did with Andy from SDR Play as the feature today. So that in this episode, so that should be hopefully good. Apart from that, I haven't been doing an awful lot of radio. At the weekend, I did switch on my HF radio to discover there was a contest on. It was absolutely wall to wall stations. There was not a single gap anywhere in any of the normal bands, apart from perhaps 17 meters to be able to actually operate. So I turned the radio off. So that's about it from me, Martin.
Yeah, fine business, Chris. Well, you've been done a little bit, which is good. Well, what have I been up to? Well, first off, for what I've been up to, just an announcement. ICQ Live is happening on the 13th of this month. It's between 1900 and 2100 UTC. Ed Durant will be in the chair. He's supported by the rest of us, but it's an event Ed wants to run on the ICQ Digital Talk Group. So keep an eye out for the newsletters. And it's a good reason why you should sign up for the ICQ podcast newsletter so that you find out all these things are happening. But 13th of April, 1900 to 2100 UTC, ICQ Live, and you can find details on the ICQ podcast website. Right, what have I been up to? Well, as Chris said, I've been to Dover Rally, and we were a bit short of staffed because Mrs. B was unable to go that day. I spent a lot of time on the table, talking to a lot of people, had some great chats. Unfortunately, nobody wanted to do it as an interview. And there was, lots of good chats had. But Chris, you did an interview with SDR Play, who were the only manufacturer at this the Dover Rally, which was fine because they're well respected, and Andy lives local anyway, which is good. And I think it all went very, very well. People at the rally told me it was like going to an old-fashioned rally where very, very sociable, lots of odds and ends under tables and whatever that they took great delight in buying. Gentleman did try and sell me a lovely microphone that looks very, very similar to our shirt logos, and he came across and he sold it to me, and I paid a little bit over the top for it at first, paid 25 quid for it, tried it out, and it was as dead as a dodo, so I went back to his stand and said, look, mate, nicest possible world, if it had worked, I was happy with 25 quid, but for 25 quid for a paperweight, it's a bit excessive. And he went, what do you mean? I said, it don't work. So he gave me my money back. But we were lucky because both Chris and I had recorders with XLR connectors on so we could test it. So that was that one. So smart radio we've been doing a couple of weeks ago, and I've got another smart radio this Saturday, the Saturday before the podcast goes out, at the local library. Been doing VHF and UHF operating. In fact, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the UHF because I was out with Edmund Easter Saturday doing 433 Alive in the UK, which is just a bit of fun. People operating UHF FM for a few hours. And we actually did it in a park, Potter Park. So that was good fun. And although I didn't do millions of contacts, I think I did 7 on UHF because Edmund was mainly working UHF, and you can't have two people next to each other in the same band. I did do 7 contacts on HF on 17 meters, had some great chats with people, and what was more probably beneficial, you could have said, why didn't I work more? But I spent a fair amount of time talking to the general public who come by saying, what are you doing? That looks interesting. You know, what are you up to? So a lot of public relations work going on. I bought myself a new rig a couple of weeks ago, and that's what I took to the park. I bought myself a Zygo G90. Now, the one I've got is a Zygo G90S. I believe the only reason the S is there is because it should have been sold for the Chinese market only. All the menus and everything work in English. The manual arrived was in Chinese only. And I think it's a Chinese market only radio got shipped to me. Not too worried because I saved myself over £100 on UK prices anyway. But just as an interesting little byproduct, I found with it a few weeks ago when I was looking at another one for somebody else. The microphone cable, if you're doing a demonstration and you want to sort of move back from the radio and move over or pass the microphone to a member of the public so that they can operate behind you and you want a longer microphone cable, a Cat5 cable works perfectly well between the rig and the microphone. And I've had one, a 5 meter one on testing, and it worked perfectly okay. So for events, a 5 meter microphone cable might be quite useful to you. And lastly, I couldn't help it. I bought myself some new screwdrivers. It's a screwdriver set. It's got pretty much all of the Phillips and Posi drive and flat blade. And then the little small modules that connect in. So massive amounts of screwdrivers, various sizes, all that sort of thing. And they're all held in a upright clip to go on the workbench. So great little tool. But there was one tool in that whole screwdriver set, which isn't anything to do with screwdrivers or radio. And I think the person who put the set together must have had a sense of humour. There's a bottle opener. So in there you can pull out your bottle opener and open your bottle of beer while you're working, if that's what floats your boat. So nice little kit, all the same. So basically that's what I've been up to. And a little bit of operating and a great lot of fun. So all that's left for me to do now is to thank the guys for turning up, and then we'll continue with the rest of the podcast. I'd like to thank Mr. Chris Howard, M0TCH.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Cheers, Chris, and good to have you. I'd like to thank Mr. Martin Rothwell.
Thank you, it's been fun.
Yeah, as always. I'd like to thank Mr. Frank Howell, K4FMH.
Thank you, Martin. We had way too much fun this time.
Yeah. And Mr. Leslie Butterfield, G0CIB.
Thanks for having me on, Martin. It's been a blast as always.
Yeah, it's good fun. And unfortunately, Bill WC3B has had to leave us. So thanks, Bill, for joining us. So all that's left for me to do is say 73s, and we'll move on. 73, guys.
See ya.
73.
Cheerio.
Keep your amateur ham radio podcast advert free by donating less than a length of coax. Visit www.icqpodcast.com/donate now. For all the news, links and information, visit www.icqpodcast.com.
Now it's time to have a look at the news in brief for me, Colin, M6BLY. A reminder, in a week or week's time, the RSGB AGM will take place on Saturday the 13th of April. It's being held online to ensure as many members can take part and watch the proceedings. The formal business of the meeting will include the results of members' votes on the resolutions, including endorsement of 3 nominated directors. RSG members are encouraged to make sure their vote counts on all the resolutions. So we'll put the link up to the page for you to make sure you can get involved and take part from there. There's a live online form you can submit if you wish to answer questions, and the recording's taking place via Zoom or via the YouTube live chat during the event, so certainly lots of ways of getting involved from there. So it's the RSGB AGM taking place on the 13th of April. SpaceX CRS-30 recently returned the ham TV system back to the International Space Station after the system was sent back to Earth for repairs in 2019. The digital amateur radio television equipment powering the ham TV is typically used in conjunction with school contacts to send video and audio of the contact events to viewers on Earth. So great news that this system was originally put into place in 2013 before it had to have repairs done 6 years later. It should be back up and running from there. The British Amateur Television Club has an extensive documentary related to ham TV, including how to receive the DVB-S protocol transmitting from the International Space Station. So as always, we'll put all that information for you on icqpodcast.com. And we finish up with news here that there is currently a new training course taking place in Puerto Rico section, and it's being offered by the ARRL to bring students along the way of the amateur ham radio hobby and interest going from there. It's being taught by the ARRL's technical coordinator and instructor Carlos Rogue, Whiskey Papa 4 Alpha Oscar Hotel. And so he'll be taking there. He's looking for 10 students, as I say, to take part in the course. So if you're in the Puerto Rico area and wish to take part in the amateur radio hobby, and that could be a great way of getting involved with Carlos to get your license from there. Right, well, now we're going to head over to our features episode, which is the Dover Rally with SDR Play. As always, I hope you enjoy.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, this episode's feature from the ICQ podcast. For this episode's feature, Chris has recorded a really good interview with SDR Play. But what I was going to tell you about very quickly is the rally itself and what happened there. The rally itself was well attended, in fairness, and you know, it was quite a small hall, but very well attended with lots of people there. I only saw a couple of guys from ICOM, one of the sales guys, one of the technicians, and the owner of the ICOM franchise in the UK, although he usually glares at me, he did again, so nothing wrong with that. For some reason, I get a funny look. But don't let that put you off. The hall was pretty much packed all day. And the beauty of it was it was just like an old-fashioned rally. We had lots of people come and chat to us on the stand. Although, as I said in what I've been up to, people just didn't want to give me an interview. One gentleman, who I know quite well, was talking to me about finding pirates and people who were just being idiots on the band. And he says he's improved his finding skills phenomenally by doing it. He says he doesn't want to pick the fight and normally just has a quiet word with them. But he said it's great. He's really honed his skills, which I thought would have been a really good, interesting interview. But he said for obvious reasons, he didn't want to let anybody know he does it. But he told me. I'm not going to give his name out, though. Don't worry about that. What else was there? I spoke to a couple of new people that new to the hobby, and they found the thought of us doing the podcast possibly very useful to them, which was good. And in fairness, the Dover Bunch are usually a very friendly group of people. So in fairness, it was a very, very old-fashioned style rally this time. Great, because you got to speak to a lot of your friends. I had lots of chats. There was a tremendous amount of socialising going on. And, yeah, apart from the RSGB, had a book stand. David from the RSGB was there, had a book stand. Everybody else was just a normal group selling their wares. And I think there were some bargains had. Edmund will tell you about his bargain transceiver he bought. And he's really happy with. Later, I'm sure, in the next episode, but just a general great day. So without further ado, I'm going to let Chris' interview run, which is the interview with SDR Play.
I'm here at the Dover Radio Rally in its March 2024, for those listening on the backlog. I'm here on the SDR Play stand with Andy. Hi, Andy.
Hiya. Thank you.
And I can't believe it's been a year since we last spoke to SDR Play.
Yeah. It's been the last event, the rally last year was the last one I did.
Okay.
Because obviously Newark didn't happen.
Yes.
So, it's kind of good to get out and about again.
Meet your customers again, I suppose, face to face. So, last time we spoke, I think SDR Connect, I think you were showing that, kind of demonstrating it wasn't available at the time, and I think that's obviously now available. So, how's that gone over the last...
Yeah, we've done a few preview releases since then. It's been very well received. It obviously doesn't have the level of functionality that Uno does, but the aim is that we're going to get there. It's great that we can just sort of, as soon as we've got a few features developed, then we'll do another build, and we'll just keep doing that until we kind of got to a point where we say, okay, this is version one, essentially, you know. It's still in preview. It sets a level of expectation, you know, but it is developing, and we've had some great feedback on its robustness. People like the way it operates, and yeah, we've had some great feedback. Obviously, a few bugs that have been reported, and we just mop those up as we go. So, yeah.
And just for those folks that aren't familiar with the SDR player, just because obviously we've gone a bit technical already, so SDR player make receivers, they're software defined. You've got a range of those. We go back to the previous episodes if you listen to us talking about those. And SDR Connect was a rewrite of the software, but SDR Uno, your original software, is only for Windows. SDR Connect is now for multiple platforms, I believe.
Yeah, so we've got a range of SDR receivers, all the way from like the entry level 1A up to the Dual Tuner Duo. And we've had SDR Uno running on Windows for a few years now, but we always sort of knew that we needed to go cross-platform. It was kind of obvious, really. We had a plan to sort of take Uno cross-platform. That didn't materialise for whatever reason. It wasn't going to happen. So we had to kind of go backwards to go forwards. And I think it will make for a better product in the end, but we've had to take some steps back to then go forward again. So, yeah, so we've got the four SDR receivers that we sell on the current lineup, and connects cross-platform Linux, Windows, Mac, and supports all of those except for the one, the RSP1.
Yeah, and I think you were saying also that the big feature with the other big feature about SDR Connect is it allows you to remotely access a. So if you've got someone's got an RSP device at a remote location, they can run a SDR Connect in server mode, and then somebody over the internet or you yourself could then remotely access that and be able to have full control of the device remotely.
Yeah, so we've got the server mode built into SDR Connect. At the rally here, I've got one of my colleagues, John Hudson. They've got his I'm accessing his server from his home, and that's worked fine. It's been up the whole time and hasn't had a problem. And that's accessing his device across my phone network because there's no Wi-Fi here.
So bandwidth wise, then it is pretty efficient. Then.
Yeah, we've got a couple of modes on there. The server modes. One's full IQ mode. And the other one is like we call it audio mode, and that's a very low bandwidth, but you can still operate. You can still get 10 megahertz of spectrum. Just operates at a very low data rate, so you can operate it and access it from anywhere.
Cool. So yeah. It's your first rally back since releasing the software. Have you had much feedback here at all about SDR Connect, or is that merely by the internet?
Yeah. Well, I had. It's funny because I had some problems getting SDR Uno up and running, and nobody noticed that it wasn't there. So I've got four terminals here, and I've got the SDR Connect on the three platforms that we support, and then SDR Uno at the end. And SDR Uno's had the least interest. So I think SDR Connect's getting more. I think the visuals, it seems to be more what people sort of expect these days, modern UI interface. And so from what I've heard today, is people just kind of, you know, yeah, we just want to see more.
And
so,
I suppose those customers that have only bought a device maybe in the last 12 months or last few months,
well,
will they ever use SDR Connect?
Well, that is the interesting thing, because one of the starting points I had for a number of the features in Connect was, well, I must make it work like SDR Uno. But the people that have been coming here today, not a lot of them have actually ever used SDR Uno. And so that's something I need to bear in mind, that, and we've had this discussion internally, is that it should be intuitive, a modern intuitive application first, and then if there is a nod to Uno because Uno did it well, then we'll build that in afterwards. But we kind of need to get that balance a bit right. We can't just expect that everybody that's going to use Connect automatically has come from Uno, because clearly what I'm hearing today at the rally is that's just certainly not the case.
Yeah. And I guess you've got a backlog of features that you're now working through for SDR Connect, so like you said, to bring it up to the same set of features that are in Uno.
Yeah, that's the idea. Was going to try and get to the level that Uno's got. So the next release will have time recordings and a frequency panel, which is essentially very like the memory panel that's in SDR Uno. Plus, we'll mop up some bugs. That's what we normally do on each of the builds as we go along. And then after that, we're going to be doing, we're looking at rig control. That's a big thing for people. RDS is another one. And we need to get the module system sort of in a better shape so that we can get third-party developers coding for it. It's been quite a challenge with the module system. It works. You know, we're writing modules ourselves. The problem is that when you get to the cross-platform perspective, you know, the way that Apple particularly require you to sign and notarize binaries and the way they distribute binaries and that sort of thing, and we're sort of slightly struggling to sort of know how to proceed with that. And I think it's fair that we make sure that we have a good solution for that before we kind of release the whole thing. A, because it'll probably mean we've got to change something anyway, so that will have an effect to all the platforms. But I think, you know, we don't want to just sort of, you know, Uno has an all Windows module system, plugin system, and there's not much point in us producing something else that is just Windows. So we want to make sure that we've produced something that does truly work on. It does work. It's just it's the delivery mechanism, really, we've got to kind of figure out, because Apple software, it doesn't like non-signed software talking to signed software, if you see what I mean. So it's a security. It's just a security thing. So,
and I think you were saying to me earlier that, and this is reflected, I think I said, now you're cross-platform, that's bringing along with it, I guess, more complexity in having to test, you know, multiple versions of the product on different platforms, as well as the multiple pieces of hardware you've got to test against. So you've got the different models of your RSP devices, plus you've got to test it now on Mac, Linux, Windows, etc.
The whole testing regime is cannot be underestimated. Obviously, we've got a number of guys internally that have got a lot of the platforms, you know, we've obviously got all of the platforms in various locations, and but we're, you know, we're adding new hardware, so, you know, we've now got to make sure that the 1B works well. Got to make sure that the RSP2 still happily works as well, even though we don't make it anymore. So it's, yeah, the whole testing regime is quite significant, and but I think if you look at the level of the feedback, you look at what we've had come back, you know, robustness has been very strong. So I think that's a big, yeah, you know, I think we're getting it right in terms of the level of testing that we're doing. It means that we're not able to get things out as quick as we'd like, but I think it's all of these things is to make it a better product in the end.
Get the balance right, yeah.
You know?
So you mentioned hardware. So I believe you've recently introduced a new new model at the entry level. Is that right?
Yeah, so we've done an improvement on the 1A. It's the RSP1B, and it has it's a metal box instead of the plastic box with the metal spray on the inside. It's got some improved performance down in HF over the 1A. So... yeah, it's slightly a bit more expensive, but it's because of its performance reasons.
And that's not been out very long, I don't think, has it?
No, it's been out I don't know, actually, a month. I lose track of time so quickly. stuck in a room writing software all day. But yeah, about a month or two, and it's gone down very, very, very well received. I've seen some really great videos online that people have been doing some comparisons of the different, you know, the 1A and the 1B. And there is a definite improvement there. So, it's been a good addition to the lineup, even if it's a bit more of a headache from the software point of view.
Sure, absolutely. Andy, before we wrap up, anything else you want to talk about before we finish up?
No, I just think we're going to obviously be doing... we keep going with the software side of things. That's what I'm just purely focused on. Be good to get back up to Newark at the end of the year. I know the guys are going to be doing Dayton and a few of the other shows.
Yeah, we'll see the guys over in Dayton, yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, that'll be a good one. And I think Friedrichshafen as well. So, yeah, I think the shows are quite important to come and support. You get that direct feedback. You can't really beat that, you know. There's a lot of stuff you can't really convey in emails and stuff, so... Actually having people here talking about the software and the hardware and how it's progressing, I don't think you can really beat that. And these rallies are a great opportunity to do that.
Ali, thank you very much for your time. Wish you the best of luck. And we'll see you, no doubt, at a future one of these events.
At the next one. Yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot,
Chris.
Cheers, then. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Hi, ICQ listeners. This is Ed, DD5LP, to tell you about ICQ Live. ICQ Live is an event that we're planning to happen in April on the 13th, and it's an opportunity for you as listeners to become part of the show itself, to ask your questions of the presenters, and also to perhaps tell us a little bit about what you're doing, your projects, and your concerns in the hobby. So please look at the website, icqpodcast.com, for the full details, and hopefully we'll hear you there on April the 13th. Bye for now.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our report there from the Dover Rally and meeting up with SDR Play and the latest things that they're up to with their fantastic product. You can catch us at Hamvention, Dayton Hamvention there in May. There'll be a select member of the ICQ podcast team available there. Myself, Martin M1MRB, Chris, Mike Zero Tang, Charlie Hotel, Bill Barnes, Whiskey Charlie 3 Bravo, and Dan Romacek, KB6NU, will be at the show for that weekend there in May. So we'll look forward to seeing you there stateside for, say, the Hamvention show in Dayton. As always, we'd like to thank our monthly subscription donors that kindly help us pay our way and keep the podcast show advert-free for you. If you've learned something from today's show and would like to show your value in what you've seen, there's a very simple way to do it. You visit icqpodcast.com/donate and select one of our options there for you to show your support and your value for the show. Now, we'd also like to thank Chris, Mike Zero Tango, Charlie Hotel, Martin, Mike Zero, Sierra Golf Lima, Frank, Kilo 4, Foxtrot Mike Hotel, Bill, Whiskey Charlie 3, Bravo, and Leslie, Golf Zero, Charlie, India, Bravo, for taking part in the news roundtable with Martin, M1MRB. Right, the only thing left to do now is for me to go make my Mrs. B a cup of tea and baby sizzling chocolate eggs still floating around the house from Easter there to tempt her with a small treat. So I'm going to bid 73s to you all, and we'll catch it all again in a fortnight's time. 73s.